So just to catch you up, we are now at the end of Jesus' final teaching to his disciples before he gives himself up to the cross. This is the end of the farewell discourse. And this teaching is basically all about mission, us reaching out to the lost with the good news about him to gather in his people. And so I just want to begin by hopefully relaxing us all and being really honest. Like, it's hard, isn't it? Evangelism is hard. It's awkward. It's costly. It takes time. It drains you of emotional energy. It involves risks. You risk relationships. You risk your own, you know, sort of pushback you can receive. It's hard. And I don't want any of us to pretend that it's easy. If you find it hard, you are not the odd one out. You're normal, okay? So let's just relax and acknowledge that. But occasionally, I do hear a believer say something like, you know, evangelism is great for some Christians, but I'm just not gifted for it. It's not my thing. Like, personally, I don't think I've been called to evangelism specifically. And when I hear that, I then also think of these very famous words from General William Booth, who founded the Salvation Army and who said this: "Not called, did you say? Not heard the call, I think you should say. Put your ear down to the Bible and hear him bid you go and pull sinners out of the fire of sin. Put your ear down to the burdened, agonized heart of humanity and listen to its pitiful wail for help. Go stand by the gates of hell and hear the damned entreat you to go to their father's house and bid their brothers and sisters and servants and masters not to come there. Then look Christ in the face, whose mercy you have professed to obey, and tell him whether you will join heart and soul and body and circumstances in the march to publish his mercy to the world." Do you hear the urgency? The mission matters. Eternity's at stake. God's glory is what we're chasing. That is the most valuable, precious thing in the universe. God's glory in the eternities of precious human beings. And so as we stand before this mission that really matters, perhaps understandably daunted by it, because it is hard, we need to look to Jesus. Because what was the case for his disciples in this passage is the case for us tonight. That truly seeing him will give us joy. The more deeply and clearly we can see him, the more joy we will get. And that joy will then be the spiritual rocket fuel to propel us on the mission. That's the dynamic at work here. The clearer and better you can see Jesus, the more you will get joy from that. And we'll talk about what that joy looks like and what it doesn't look like in a second. But the more you will get joy from that, and that joy is the spiritual rocket fuel that will propel us on the mission of reaching out to the lost. When you see Jesus clearly, your evangelism will never be the same again. And in these verses, Jesus is going to help us see him. He's going to show us three things about him in particular as we go about the mission. And here's the first. If you're taking notes in the meeting program, the first is this: his presence. He's telling the disciples, them then and us tonight, about his presence. The truth that although he's not physically with us, not yet at least, he will be returning, count on that. Nonetheless, he is alive. He's ruling over the universe. He's looking down on us tonight, this afternoon, right now, in this sanctuary. He knows us. He loves us. He's with us. He's around. And we see this truth in verses 16 to 22. So have a look at verse 16. He says, "A little while and you will see me no longer." So that's referring to his death, his 3 days in the tomb. They'll think he's gone. And he goes on, "And again a little while, and you'll see me." In other words, I will have risen. I'll be alive. I'll be around. Now, the good old disciples who we've grown to know and love throughout the last 16 chapters don't get it. They're scratching their heads over what he's saying. So he clarifies and expands. Verse 20, "Truly, truly, I say to you," he's saying, "listen to me now. You will weep and lament, and the world will rejoice." Now, as he was hanging on the cross and sealed in the tomb, I'm sure the Pharisees and the teachers of the law and the crowd who had screamed, "Crucify him," were rejoicing. But then he goes on, verse 20, "You will be sorrowful because of my death, but your sorrow will turn to joy. I'll be back." That's what I was saying at the beginning. And the more that truth can sink in for us, that he's back, alive and ruling the universe, never to die again, the more we will have that bulletproof joy that will fuel us for the mission. Now, that joy doesn't look like going around, regardless of what is happening in our lives, with a big, silly grin on our faces. Christians still weep. What this joy means is having a deep sense that no matter what happens in life, everything is going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay because Jesus Christ is back. He's alive. He loves us. He's in control. He's back. And for the disciples, that joy was so strong that it would reverse and override and cancel their heart-rending grief at him being taken from them. And Jesus illustrates that in the following way, verse 21. "When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come." So think of the agony of labor. "But when she's delivered the baby, new life, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also you have sorrow now, but there will be new life. But I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you." And no one can take our joy from us. That's the principle. That's what I mean by our joy being bulletproof. If someone's able to kill Jesus again, then they will have taken my joy. But if they can't do that, they're not taking my joy. No one will take it from us, is Jesus' promise here. It's invincible. One commentator sums it up like this: "Because the presence of Christ is rooted in the resurrection, a historical event that can never be undone, it is a joy that no one can ever take from us." Now, I was mulling on this week, and I was reminded of a certain rap song, which I love, and I want to share some of the lyrics now. Now, just to warn you guys, and I know this will be a big shock to some of you, I'm actually not an achingly cool gangster rap artist. I know, it's true. I'm afraid this is going to be an upper-middle-class, white, very uncool guy reading the lyrics of the amazing Shai Lin, who's the exact opposite of all of those things, and who I've had the great privilege of meeting a couple of times. I recommend him. And so I know this rendition might sound a bit ridiculous, but think of me reading his lyrics as an expression of the beautiful diversity of God's kingdom. Anyway, his lyrics make the point very powerfully that Jesus is back, and this is from his song, "Jesus is Alive." "Elvis is dead. Picasso is dead. Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin are dead. Marilyn Monroe is dead. However, Jesus is alive. Brando is dead. James Brown is dead. Princess Di and John Lennon are dead. Biggie and Pac are dead. However, Jesus is alive. Give praise to King Jesus, the blessed Son, victorious, glorious, resurrected one. To him belongs the power, honor, and glory. Ascended where he sits at the right hand of the Father. At the cross he made atonement, his people he saved. After 3 days he was raised in defeat of the grave. By faith the elect behold him, his scepter is golden. He must have been hot or slippery because death couldn't hold him. The spotlight is always on today's icons. In 1,000 years no one will care, their light's gone. But at that time Christ will still shine bright. He's not in the limelight, he is the limelight. Criminal-minded, you've been blinded. Looking for the body of Jesus, you won't find it. We never lack spirit, letting you cats hear it, because his tomb is empty, like most secular rap lyrics. Plato is dead. Socrates is dead. Aristotle and Immanuel Kant are dead. Nietzsche and Darwin are dead. However, Jesus is alive. Buddha is dead. Muhammad is dead. Gandhi and Haile Selassie are dead. Elijah Muhammad is dead. However, Jesus is alive. Throughout history, there's been mad religious teachers, prophets, preachers, scholars, leaders. But when it came to the grave, no one could climb out. That's where Jesus stands alone, like taking a time out. And don't be misled, I've got a level head. No resurrection, Christianity would never have spread. The disciples weren't stupid guys who would ruin their lives and then choose to die for what they knew was a lie. That would be beyond ridiculous. Now, the issue is the risen Christ was seen by 500 eyewitnesses. Imagine 500 people in a court of law, each of them taking the stand, reporting what they saw. If their stories lined up and all made sense, the evidence would have to leave you convinced. But still, it's by faith that we trust and praise the Son who was gloriously raised for our justification. Nero is dead. Constantine is dead. Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun are dead. Alexander the Great is dead. However, Jesus is alive. Napoleon is dead. Lao Tzu is dead. Che Guevara and Henry VIII are dead. Saddam Hussein is dead. However, Jesus is alive. United with Christ, we reside in his light, abide in his might, keep in stride as we fight the pride in our lives, the lies and the spite. We strive to be wise as he guides through the night. He'll chide and he'll slice. Recognize that he's right. His brightness inside lights our eyes and it's tight. Pharaoh is dead. Cyrus is dead. Darius and Sennacherib are dead. Nebuchadnezzar is dead. However, Jesus is alive. Caesar is dead. Herod is dead. Annas, Caiaphas, and Judas are dead. Pontius Pilate is dead. However, Jesus is alive. Just call me shy. People often confuse us. The second thing Jesus tells, so I hope that fires us up, right? It's just nothing that isn't what Jesus is saying here, colored in with a little bit of historical context and some good theology. He's back, he's alive, he's around. We have his presence. Secondly, he tells his disciples that while on the mission, they'll have not just his presence, but his provision. First, his presence. Second, his provision. And this is in verses 23 to 28. And this is limitless provision from Jesus. This is literally a blank check when we ask for the right things and the best things. Now, sometimes we have trouble perceiving what are the right things, what are the best things. And we get confused and our vision is very muddied by things like our desire for our own glory and our selfishness and our lack of faith and our lack of data. We're just not omniscient like he is. But luckily, God in his wisdom does know better. And when we ask for the right things and the best things, there is nothing Jesus Christ will not make sure that we get. Have a look at the second half of verse 23. John 16, halfway through 23. Truly, truly, I say to you, again, that's Jesus saying, don't miss this. Whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. And the kicker there is that all-important phrase, in my name. And it comes again in verse 24, where Jesus says, until now you've asked nothing in my name. Now, when Jesus talks about in my name, what does that mean? That's a way of referring to his character, his nature, his identity. So to pray for things in his name means to ask for things in accordance with who he is, in alignment with his will, things that further his mission and please him and reflect what he's about. Now, I love that we have a few military veterans in Emmanuel. And let's just imagine for a second that you're a soldier on the front line, say in Afghanistan, fighting terrorists. And you're out there in the middle of the desert, in your compound, up in a watchtower, and you're keeping a lookout through your binos, looking for suspicious movement. And suddenly, in the far distance, you just spot a group of fighting-age males, and they're jumping into jeeps, they are getting out rocket launchers, they're loading Kalashnikovs, and you realize they're gearing up for an attack. And so you quickly get on the radio, and you call up HQ to tell HQ the situation and to make a request. And the HQ comes up on the radio, and they say, well, what do you need? And you say, well, I need an artillery strike. Right, here are the grid squares. Here's how many rounds are going to be needed to take out these guys. Here's the type of rounds that are going to be most effective in this situation. Now, because you're asking for things in line with the commander's mission, there's basically no limit to what they will say yes to. They'll give you whatever you want if it's those kinds of things. They'll be like, sure, on its way. because you're asking for things that please your commander, which are in line with his will. In a sense, you're asking for things in his name that reflect what he's all about. If HQ came up on the radio after you'd explained the situation and they said, what do you need? And you'd said, I need a cheeseburger, hold the onions, fries, I'll have a Diet Coke, and let's go for a, Reese's Pieces shake. And some nail clippers, because I've got this really annoying little hangnail that's been bugging me for days on my little finger. Guess what? You're probably not going to get it. Jesus' promise of infinite provision is within the bounds of what is asked for in his name. Now, God does love us. He loves to bless us. He's a giving God. Sometimes he will give us the cheeseburger and the fries and the Coke and the shake. Sometimes he will give us beautiful weather and financial provision and good health and a parking spot. But he never guarantees them. We're not entitled to them. In fact, often it might well be better for our effectiveness in the mission, better for our growth in Christ-likeness, not to get those things. What we are guaranteed is that God will fulfill his mission of gathering in his son's people. And when we ask for things in line with that, there is literally no limit to what our prayers can trigger. And when you get to see God using your prayers like that, you see the miracle of repentance and faith as spiritual corpses are raised to life, or doors for the gospel open. Nothing is more fulfilling and joyful to watch. And it's quite surreal, realizing that God is using you to shift things around in the world around you, just through you saying stuff to him. As Jesus says at the end of verse 24, ask and you will receive, that your joy may be full. And the disciples went on to experience this and learn this. Look at verse 26. Jesus says, in that day you will ask in my name. So they got to find out what this was like. And then Jesus goes on, and I do not say to you that I will ask the Father on your behalf. He's saying, look, by that point, I will have died on the cross and brought you into direct fellowship with the Father. You'll be able to ask him direct yourself. And verses 27 and 28 reinforce that point as well. And this side of the cross, that is our privilege. That is our position. We have the unbelievable privilege of direct access to God the Father, because of Jesus' death on the cross for our justification. In other words, that granted us his righteousness as a status when he took our sinfulness so that the Father could accept us. So we can talk direct to the Father, as Jesus promised would be the case for his disciples. And when we ask for things in line with his son to advance his mission, there is no limit to what he can do with that. As Jesus says in verse 23, whatever we ask, it's exciting. And one writer says this about prayer. I strongly suspect that if we saw all the difference that our prayers to God make and all the people those prayers were destined to affect and all the consequences of those effects down through the centuries, we would be so paralyzed with awe at the power of prayer that we would be unable to get up off our knees for the rest of our lives. Like, who knows how God has used your prayers? I think it might beg a belief if we were shown behind the curtain right now. To quote another writer, a prayerless Christian is like a bus driver trying alone to push his bus out of a rut because he doesn't know that Clark Kent is on board. I've got just one cross-reference for us. Can everyone just grab your meeting program? Turn to page 9 at the back. And just have a look at item number 1, the top item on page 9 of the meeting program. See you there. Finally, as well as his presence and his provision, finally, there's his position, And we see this in verses 29 to 33. And by his position, I mean his position as one who's overcome the world, his position at the top of the universe, a position of authority and victory and triumph. Look at verse 24. In this world, you will have tribulation. Yes, the mission isn't easy. Yes, life is hard. Yes, we'll face disadvantage and persecution. But, says Jesus, take heart. I have overcome the world. Yes, the going can be tough. Jesus has already won. And the Bible describes this world as being like enemy territory. It may not feel like it much in Tennessee. Ask millions of our brothers and sisters all around the rest of the world, not in the Bible Belt, they would laugh. Of course this world is enemy territory. Many of them have the scars to prove it. So this world is enemy territory, but if we're with Jesus Christ, we're on the side that has already won. He has overcome the world. And that's true even when we fail him, because we will fail him. And yet he won't fail us. Look at verse 32. Behold, the hour is coming. Indeed, it has come, he says to his disciples, when you will be scattered, each to his home, and you will leave me alone. They'll fail him. They'll let him down. They'll crumple, just like we will. But then he goes on, yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. Like Jesus doesn't need us. I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. So as we start to draw to a close, just picture right now some of the people who God has deliberately placed in your life who seem like they may be lost, who are edging closer to being lost for all eternity without end, like we heard from General William Booth at the beginning. Now consider the prospect of talking to them about Christ or urging them to come with you to church where they can encounter him or giving them a gospel resource. Now, that is not easy, like we said at the start. That may result in a friendship cooling off, some social awkwardness, your career going less well, your family getting ticked off with you. The mission isn't easy, but if your heart sinks at the thought of that, don't let it. Take heart, because we have the presence of Christ. He's alive. He's back. We have the provision of Christ. Nothing is beyond what he can do with our prayers as we go about the mission. And we have the position of Christ. He's ruling the world. He has had total victory and authority and triumph and utter control. So let's be brave. Let's spread the word.